the middle class is a powerful idea in the United States, shaping our economic policies and, in many ways, our political conversations. And there are more than a few ways to measure exactly who is part of it. Our next guest researches the middle class through the lens of wealth and how we build it. Her work finds a large gap between black and white Americans when it comes to reaching a middle class level of wealth. There are a lot of reasons for that, including the uneven impact of student debt on college graduates. Fenaba Otto is the Lorna Jorgensen-Wendt Associate Professor of Money, Relationships, and Equality in UW-Madison's Department of Consumer Science. Fenaba, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I understand that there are different ways economists and others try to measure middle class status. You look at it through the lens of wealth. Could you talk about how and why you do that?
Yes. So we believe that wealth is the probably the best economic indicator of understanding class status in the United States. So at a very basic level, you know, I'm calling it wealth, but it also is in capturing net wealth, which is the difference between what one owns, so their assets minus their liabilities, right? So what they owe. And it captures the full, you know, household balance sheet. But it also allows us information about access, right? So when we're talking about access, like how much, what is one's access to power, to privilege, to prestige? How much access do you have to resources, and when do you have access to those resources across one's life, and are the ability to pass on resources and secure resources intergenerationally? So it's so much more than just an economic indicator, right? And as you already referenced, I also look at this with regard to wealth inequality. And so we believe that using a wealth-based metric for understanding middle-class status provides a clearer picture for understanding the wealth positioning of Black American households.
Before we dig into that a little more, just I want to compare and contrast other ways to look at middle-class status. We could think about income, but I guess if we did that, a person making $50,000 but, say, having no debt, at a person making $50,000 and having $100,000 of debt, those are people in two very different situations, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, these comparisons are important, especially at times like this, like we're in currently, in which we have a lot of economic precarity and financial instability due to the global pandemic that's been happening and the potential for a recession if people lose their access to their income and they don't have a private social safety net such as wealth to draw upon during these times, then they can, you know, experience quickly downward mobility. So this is the example that you gave is exactly right. So if you lose your access to your income, but you have some wealth to draw upon to kind of weather the economic instability, then that household is going to fare a little bit better than a household that doesn't have access, but even may have debt. And when that debt comes due and you can't pay it off, you're especially precarious, right? Your financial situation is highly, you know, mm-hmm. you know, poor. It's pretty bad. So, yeah.
Now, we know, I think we have a sense that there are different kinds of disparities of income and wealth between Black and white Americans here in Wisconsin in particular, maybe. When we look at it through this lens of wealth, our assets, less our liabilities, our debts, our access and things like that, what do we see?
Well, what we see is, so what we do, you know, in the work that we've been doing is just kind of dividing up the wealth distribution into quintiles, and we're just going to assign like the middle three quintiles as middle class. When we do that, and then we start to, you know, we say stratify or disaggregate by race, we see what we refer to as this lower ladder phenomenon, which is that even, so we can start at the top wealth quintile, the median wealth of Black households who sit at the top wealth quintile, so who are, you know, doing fairly well, their median wealth is less than the wealth profiles of white households who are in the next wealth quintile. So what this translates into is that we don't see their wealth positioning translating into the same benefits, outcomes as whites who are in similar wealth positionings. And this, you know, this can have real implications for what we see, how things play out on a day-to-day basis or in times when there is a recession or economic downturns, right? So why do certain households, why do Black households experience higher rates of downward mobility, for example? Because, you know, in the median or the typical household does not have the same amount of resources than in comparison to white households.
We're talking to Fenneba Otto, associate professor in the Department of Consumer Science at UW-Madison, looking at what it means to be in the middle class, measuring it by wealth, which includes factoring in things like debt, and finding out some of the disparities between Black and white America and how we got there. And Fenneba, if I read your research correctly, part of the story here is a generational story. The parents who can't pay for their kids' college, well, that next generation might be in a similar position to them. Can you talk about how these things translate over generations?
Yeah. So the work that we have been doing is really trying to highlight or shed light on the relationships between racial wealth disparities within our society and its connection to what we're seeing, especially among recent cohorts of young adults, growing student debt disparities. So what that means is if we have these wealth disparities, parents cannot provide the same resources, cannot transfer financial resources, can't help pay for college, and their students therefore have to take on debt in order to pursue higher education, pursue a college degree. If you have that debt and you're entering into young adulthood, it takes a little while longer to pay that debt down. I can also get into the high rates of default and delinquency that we see amongst Black college borrowers. And those processes end up delaying future wealth accumulation and also are contributing to growing debt disparities.
Can you talk more about the default situation for Black Americans on student loan debt?
Yeah, so what we actually see in the data is that independent of college completion status, Black borrowers have the highest rates of default and delinquency on their student loan debt. We actually see that they default pretty early on in the repayment process, which is associated with having higher loan balances. And, you know, we know from work that we do on, you know, consumer finances is that these defaults and delinquencies can ding one's credit, right? And so there are both short-term and long-term effects of the default and delinquency. As I already mentioned, the long-term effects can be delays in accumulation of future assets, but it also can mean that it makes borrowing more costly. If you want to eventually buy that house or, you know, buy a car, if you have things on one's credit or low credit scores, the implications are very real, you know, and materialize very quickly on one's balance sheet, one household's balance sheet. And it's disproportionately we see happening among Black student borrowers.
We're talking to Fenneba Otto right now, associate professor of consumer science at UW-Madison, looking at her research on how we measure the middle class in America and racial gaps in wealth accumulation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you feel like it means to be middle class? Does it make sense to you to use wealth as opposed to something like, say, income or profession or job as a way to measure it? What do you see as barriers to growing personal wealth? Are things like debts, student loan debt, or other kinds of debt limiting your own financial situation, your ability to maybe make a better life for your kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Fenneba Otto, associate professor of money, relationships, and equality at UW-Madison, looking at how we measure the middle class and racial gaps we see in personal wealth and things like student debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think constitutes being middle class? Do you think it's gotten harder for people to build personal wealth? Has student debt affected your ability to gain wealth and maybe become or stay middle class? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Feniba, you used the word precarious earlier. We've had two big economic shocks in just recent memory, the Great Recession, and then the economic shutdown that came along with COVID-19. How does that affect different groups differently? People with that firmer grasp, I guess, on middle class, and people who are just kind of barely hanging on?
Yeah, so it affects them differently because we see when we look at the data, the concentration of where people fall in the middle class to vary very differently. So if we look at Black households, they're more likely to fall into that lower quintile, right? So if you have just a few months, let's just say just a few months of emergency savings, given the current pandemic, it's kind of, we're waiting on a vaccine, for example, right? And so we're not quite sure how long this might last. And so if you only have, you know, the standard 3 to 6 months of emergency savings to help you weather this current period, you may already have either experienced downward mobility or may be very close to not being able to meet your bills or your needs. And therefore, we will see this shifting in who can actually constitute or fall into the middle class, this middle class criteria. So that concentration varies by race and ethnicity, whereas we, you know, like I said, Black Americans are much more likely to be falling down into the lower wealth quintiles as compared to white Americans, who are a little bit more evenly distributed across the wealth quintiles.
We had a call from Frank in Milwaukee who couldn't stay on the line. Frank was wondering if you had any ideas about what the experience was like for the Latino population. We've been talking about Black and white so far. Do we have data to work with on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say we know a little bit, but we always need more and better data to help us learn more about what is happening. I will say that their wealth profiles tend to fall in between Black Americans, which tend to be the lowest, and white Americans, which tend to be larger than Hispanic or Latinx populations. So they are also, their amounts of student loan debt that they're acquiring is growing. And I think it'll be very important to see what happens, especially during this moment, with regard to college completion and their ability to not accumulate lots of debt as we navigate this moment. But yeah, that's a great question.
We also heard from Paul on Facebook who writes, middle class seems to mean two jobs and carrying a lot of debt to look like you're living the same lifestyle your grandparents lived, with one job and everything paid in cash. I don't know if this is something you look at, Feniba. Is there something there where what it takes to have what we think of as a middle class lifestyle, the goalposts have moved over time?
Yeah, and so I think this is makes like that point makes the case for why we should be looking at wealth to define middle class status, because I think it captures both notions about what it takes to be middle class with the realities of the economic situation that they find themselves in. Other terms that you often maybe hear are like the fragile middle class. Why is this? Why are they so highly over leveraged? Why do they have so much debt at this moment? You know, this is, if we look and we start teasing out, you know, we're not going to be able to capture that just by looking at income or just by looking at occupational status, which are pretty, you know, the kind of conventional or standard measures of socioeconomic status that academics tend to use. So we think that, you know, we need to start thinking a little bit more broadly and incorporating measures of debt and you know, the value of one's assets to kind of understand what it means. And I think this categorization actually allows us to group a larger number of households into our understanding of what it means middle class. You know, oftentimes we hear a lot of people saying, I consider myself middle class. I consider myself middle class, but if you look at their, you know, their household balance sheet, it could vary quite differently. and I think that the wealth definition actually speaks to this.
With college debt, it seems like there's a catch-22 here where we know there's a wage premium for having that college degree, and we often think of the college degree as a road to social mobility, but for a lot of people, it sounds like it's a road to debt and maybe limiting the room for mobility. How do we sort that out?
It is increasingly becoming so. That is the case. I think that's why this is an important part of the conversation when we are talking about what it means for students and their families navigating college these days, and how it's how student debt is becoming increasingly a larger share of one's wealth portfolio, right? Like we spoke about earlier, the idea of wealth being intergenerational, the debt that a student takes on can have long-lasting impacts for not only themselves but their families. And I think this is why we can't minimize the growing importance of what it means, because yes, if we look at, again, the conventional measures such as income, we do see continued returns to that college education paying off in the long term. But if we expand that definition to incorporate wealth-based metrics, then for some certain populations, which tend to have higher rates of, who take on average, higher average loan debt or loan balances in order to pursue that education, then it's going to not necessarily lead to higher wealth. And that tends to be disproportionately Black American and Black borrowers.
Feniba, in our last minute and a half or so, can you point us toward, I guess, possible solutions to make that precarious middle-class existence less precarious?
Yeah, so I tend to focus a little bit more on student debt, and I'm very much in the conversations around how we need to think about how to decrease the amount that debt that households are accumulating, as well as help them pay it off quicker. So thinking about, you know, income-based repayment programs, thinking about, do we need to think about debt cancellation for certain populations, especially those who are not seeing the returns on their education, such as those who may have had attended for-profit institutions? And then how do we also think about regulating markets that may be engaging in discriminatory practices, such as real estate markets, loan lending credit markets as well? So really think we have to think about reducing the debt, but also increasing the assets that these households are interacting with.
And briefly, Feniba, what are you going to be looking at next in your own research?
Oh, I'm continuing actually to look at the middle class as they weather the current pandemic. I'm also doing some new work on understanding what it might mean to be working class as we see changes in the future of work and growing occupational segmentation. So yeah, I'm excited about that work as well.
Feniba,
always looking with a lens to debt and wealth. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Feniba Otto is an associate professor of money, relationships, and equality at UW-Madison's Department of Consumer Science. She talked with us today about her research on racial gaps in the middle class and how student debt can affect college graduates. Lawyers for Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old charged with killing two protesters in Kenosha, told an Illinois judge Friday that they would fight extradition charges to Wisconsin. Rittenhouse has become something of a hero to some on the right. Sean Johnson reports on those calling him a patriot.
After Kenosha police shot Jacob Blake, a Black man, in the back multiple times, the city erupted into protest. On August 25th, Kyle Rittenhouse made the 20-mile trip to Kenosha from his home in Antioch, Illinois. Rittenhouse, a lifeguard and a vocal supporter of police, said he was there to protect a local business and offer medical help if needed. He walked through the crowds that night with an AR-15 rifle strapped to his chest. What happened that night is disputed and will eventually be hashed out in court, but a full-scale public relations blitz is underway by some of Rittenhouse's supporters. A group called the Fight Back Foundation released a dramatic video compilation of cell phone footage from the night of the shootings. It claims Rittenhouse fired his gun only after being chased and attacked. The narrator speaks of Rittenhouse being sacrificed by politicians.
But it's not Kyle Rittenhouse they're after. Their endgame is to strip away the constitutional right of all citizens to defend our communities, our personal property, our lives, and the lives of our loved ones.
Rittenhouse's cause got the attention of conservative media figures. Here's former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi on Fox News.
What's it coming to in these liberal cities when teenagers have to go out there to try to provide aid?
Last week, conservative commentator Michelle Malkin joined Rittenhouse's mom and lawyer at an event for Republican Party women in Waukesha County. Malkin tweeted that they received a standing ovation. The Fight Back Foundation says it's raised almost $2 million for Rittenhouse. The group's chairman is Lynn Wood, a prominent attorney who made a name for himself representing Richard Jewell in the 1996 Olympic bombing case. Longtime Wisconsin defense lawyer Dean Strang, who is not involved in this case, says the teen's attorneys may well argue self-defense.
But it has nothing to do, in the first instance, with being a hero, and has everything to do with whether you'll be held responsible for killing other people or you won't.
Kyle Rittenhouse is charged with first-degree reckless homicide in the death of 36-year-old Joseph Rosenbaum and first-degree intentional homicide in the death of 26-year-old Anthony Huber. Huber's surviving partner, Hannah Giddings, is among a group of plaintiffs who this week filed a civil lawsuit against Rittenhouse and a Kenosha militia group. In a YouTube clip, she talks about Huber.
He did not deserve that. He was a good human being.
The plaintiffs are also suing Facebook for publicizing the militia group's call to arms. John Pierce is Rittenhouse's lead attorney. He told the conservative news site Breitbart that his client had a God-given right to be in the city that night.
I will tell you, and there's no doubt about this, that if every law-abiding American showed up in the city that they love with an AR-15, the chaos would stop immediately.
University of Arizona sociology professor Jennifer Carlson says, the Rittenhouse case aside, it does appear more people are embracing violence as a solution in 2020. Carlson has researched gun politics for the past decade. In interviews with gun sellers this year, she's found more people who feel like institutions have broken down. Instead of the ballot box, they're turning to boxes of bullets.
People are beginning to really think that we have reached the point of no return with regard to violence. And whether we have or not, if people believe that we have, that is very troubling.
Kyle Rittenhouse remains in custody in Lake County, Illinois. He's due back in court on October 9th for another status update on his extradition case. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.